Okay, so let me just summarize the blackboard scribbles. I was trying to make 2 points. One, that there is a fairly obvious compromise between the game and the bandwidth. That is, you have to wait for a long time in order to build up a large game. So alternatively, the gain and time constant are naturally related in the system. And another long digression here on the blackboard was about describing fluctuations and noise. And to make a long story short, the argument was that even though, strictly speaking, one has to start with the master equation, and the master equation will describe the joint probability distribution of numbers of all chemical components in the system, it is it often suffices to use the Langevin approach. And the criterion is the number of molecules per diffusive correlation length. I'm sorry? Okay. So now I'm wired. Okay, this is better.
Yeah.
Somehow up here don't realize that microphone actually does something. But anyway, so the argument was that you can just use the Langevin approach to describe the fluctuations on top of these mean field or chemical kinetics description. And of course, the fluctuations are treated then on a Gaussian level, and strictly speaking, the whole thing is correct only as long as fluctuations are relatively small. But anyway, we can calculate, going back to our push-pull amplifier, we can add the Langevin noise term, and we can calculate the fluctuations in the number of active messenger, and we're going to find that it is proportional to, in fact, the total number of messengers that were activated and deactivated during the correlation time tau. And please notice here that we're talking not about concentrations, but about total numbers, right? So this is really a total number of messengers that got that went around the loop in time tau, in the relevant time tau. So now we can calculate signal-to-noise ratio in the simple push-pull loop, and it boils down to this following expression. It is all proportional to the turnover rate in time tau, and well, of course, it's proportional to the strength of input signal rate, the modulation of the enzyme, activating enzyme concentration at the input. So the compromise here is that if you want to increase the signal to noise, you have to either increase the time constant and sacrifice the bandwidth. And again, this is obvious because effectively by increasing the time constant, you are going to average over more time steps, more independent events. Yes? Yes. 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 So at the moment, you know, to the extent that the response is linear, we can happily integrate over the whole system and talk about fluctuations in the total number just as well. But the moment the nonlinearity appears, you can no longer do that. And we'll have to put back a diffusion term and worry about non-uniformity of the signaling. And that, of course, will become relevant if you have only a single receptor molecule activated. And we'll come back to that in about 10 minutes.
Right.
Yes, precisely. They're potentially important because we're looking at reasonably small reactor volumes. Right. Okay, so anyway, another way of increasing signal to noise ratio is just increase the total number of these molecular events, increase the total number of messengers, and the overall turnover rate. And right then we're basically going to this larger bucket, and noise tends to average out. So there is no surprise. But of course, if we're doing business in a larger bucket, we're paying some finite amount of energy, right? We're dissipating some finite amount per molecule here. So we'll spend more, we'll dissipate more power in the amplifier. So we have these trade-offs that we cannot make signal to noise arbitrarily large, but exactly how much gain, how much signal to noise do we need in a transduction system? And well, the minimal amount of gain is what is required to take your minimal statistically significant input, you know, such as one photon in the dark, and amplify it so that this transduced signal exceeds the noise at the output, or if you like, the noise of your readout device. And since, as we saw somewhere, the gain is proportional to the messenger concentration, this lower bound on the gain immediately implies a lower bound on the amount of this chemical messenger you have to have in your system. So this gives you the first elementary flavor of the constraint that the function imposes on the chemistry. So if you want to transduce signals, you want the gain to be sufficiently large, and therefore you need appropriately high concentration of the messenger. And this is basically what we want to do. We want to go back to the actual Fourier transduction cascade and try to identify various constraints on the amounts of various transduction components. So from functional requirements of signal transduction, we want to identify some constraints on the organization of the cascade. And this bound on the minimal gain is just one of such constraints. There are many other things that, as an engineer, you will worry about. So for example, you have to correctly bias the steady state, right? In the steady state in the dark is corresponds to depolarized state of the cell. So there is a current running. What you will want as an engineer is to match the impedance of the outer segment of the cell with an inner segment of the cell. So here is the outer segment. It is connected to the inner segment, and there is current flowing in here, and there's current flowing out in the inner segment. And what you want is to match the conductivity of this outer cell with the conductivity of the inner cell. And that immediately tells you roughly how many channels you need to keep open in the dark. And that in turn sets the level of, if you remember, channels were kept open by the cyclic GMP. So it tells you the cyclic GMP level, and that level was in turn set by guanylyl cyclase. So adjusting the concentration and let's just say adjusting the concentration of guanylyl cyclase is the way of simply controlling the number of open channels. Of course, another thing you can do is you can increase the total number of channels that you stick in the membrane. So strictly speaking, it is only the product of these two that is constrained.
Yes. So these optimizations considerations, are you intending to use them to infer what certain parameters have to be in the cell which you can't measure? Or when the cell is given, you can't really.
Yes. Yes. Well, you know. I wouldn't really say as much as optimization, because I think all the estimates that we'll arrive at will be just within an order of magnitude of what is observed. And it's not at all obvious that the cell is really trying to optimize everything very well, but all we want to accomplish is understand what parameters the cell has to control various important aspects of its behavior. So we just want to identify the knobs that that the cell has. And you know, the very important sort of philosophical issue is, of course, there are also kinetic parameters everywhere. And in principle, you can start, you can imagine varying these parameters, but and you can consider different designs. You can try redesigning the cell altogether. So, for example, the rod operates, you know, is depolarized in the dark, and you may ask, why is it wasting energy and running the current in the dark? Maybe you can design a better cell which will shut the current off in the dark. And we could probably come up with some good reasons for why it wants to keep the current flowing, but then you will learn that in invertebrates it's actually the other way around. So that is rather a bucket of cold water on that reasoning. So for all that we want to do here is take the network architecture, take the all the kinetic constants as God-given, and ask, given these little gizmos, what kind of a system can you design? And then all your tunable parameters are how much of this enzyme you take or how much that enzyme you take. And the purpose of this exercise is just to demonstrate how much you can do with these parameters. Of course, there are certain things that are limited by kinetic constants. So, for example, the gain bandwidth product will be limited by enzyme kinetics. There's nothing you can do about it, at least in the single stage. You can beat it by making a multi-stage cascade. But still, even within given architecture and given kinetic constraints, you want to identify the tuning parameters, and that's essentially what we're doing. So okay, so then there is this overall gain consideration. So you will identify the output noise to beat as the fluctuations in vesicle release, and so getting this output noise estimate from that, we arrive at the estimate of the necessary gain for the two stages at 10 to the 4, and then it turns out that most of this gain comes from the first G protein stage, right? The sensitivity of phosphodiesterase activation to activation of rhodopsin. And that's where the constraint on the number of rhodopsin comes from. And phosphodiesterase, in turn, turns out to be pinned by time constant matching considerations that I described, right? In this multi-stage cascade, you want to match the time constants typically. So you want all these time constants to be on the order of response time, which is 1 second. And that will give you a lower bound on what on the number of phosphodiesterases you want. So you will be reassured to find that the experimentally observed numbers of these various enzymes, which I quote in the literature, are happily consistent with what an engineer would want. But I think there is really a larger issue that is involved in this. The question is, are these enzyme concentrations, or effectively numbers of various proteins, really fixed in the cell, or are they tuned? So the distinction is, you can imagine that rod cells are hardwired. It is written in their DNA that they should express the gene encoding the G protein at a certain level, so that the cell will end up with 10 to the 8 G proteins. But perhaps there is a rather more, right, and in that case it will make perfect sense to quote in the textbook that the rod cell has 10 to the 8 molecules. But perhaps there is really dynamical tuning that is involved. And instead of being pre-programmed for the number of proteins, the cell is pre-programmed for a function. And this function would be phototransduction. So phototransduction means that the cell wants to see correlation between the input light and the output voltage. And you can certainly imagine there being a little chemical circuit which sort of correlates the fluctuations at the input at the first stage of phototransduction with the fluctuations at the output stage of phototransduction. So roughly think of tuning, the way you set, or at least used to set, the recording level on the tape deck. So you observe the needle and you want that needle to get into the red, but not too much. And you adjust the knob appropriately. And you can very easily imagine enzymatic circuitry which will do just that, and have the feedback act on the level of control of gene expression. To some extent, we know that it's happening. I think one context, there are actually many contexts where we know that it's happening. One context is addiction. In fact, I think I already mentioned that opiate receptors happen to be those G protein coupled receptors, very, very analogous. And that signaling pathway goes through, cyclic GMP, it goes through cyclic AMP, same difference. And the phenomenon of addiction is a response to high level of activation of these opiate receptors, which causes a reduction in the level of expression of adenyl cyclase. So the system actually tunes down the gain, and it is happening on a time scale of days. And in this context of phototransduction, we talk about adaptation, we talk about this negative feedback through calcium, but these are the mechanisms on a time scale of seconds and maybe tens of seconds. And it would be very interesting to find out what's happening on much longer time scales, where you can actually start rewiring, retuning the cell. And we don't know how that works, but at least we understand what knobs there are to twiddle with. Okay, I'm going to finish off with just one other small tidbit, just to amuse you with a quasi-mystery. So there is this peculiar phenomenon that I mentioned in the beginning. So rods detect single photons, and they do so very reproducibly. So what you're supposed to see here is this bunch of single photon blips. Sometimes you'll see these larger blips. They correspond to two photons. Sometimes you'll see blips here, which are not coincident with any light flash at all. These are spontaneous isomerization events. This is just thermal activation of rhodopsin. And it happens very, very rarely, but there is a lot of rhodopsin in the cell. So events like this actually happen every, I guess, 30 seconds or so. And these events sit on this noise background, and this noise background can largely be attributed to fluctuations in the level of cyclic GMP. So if you make up a histogram of that, you'll find a peak corresponding to this continuous noise background. And then you'll find a bump corresponding to single photon and something plausible for a two photon. And if you look at, so this is your average single photon response. And if you look at the fluctuations of the peak response, I'm sorry, so that's plotted right here. This is the peak response. You'll find that the standard deviation over the mean is about 1/5. And this is a bit puzzling because this is just single photon. It's single receptor. And for the longest time, I was saving this. This picture of rhodopsin deactivation. So so rhodopsin was phosphorylated first, and actually it is known to allow some largish number, maybe five, it has five phosphorylation sites. So it may well be phosphorylated more than once. So, and so PN, and then it binds arrestin, and gets deactivated. So why is 1/5 a small number? It's a small number if you compare it to a single molecular, single step deactivation. So if this deactivation went through just one step, right, you would think, right, and if you assume that the peak response is just proportional to the time that rhodopsin is spent in its active conformation, which is, and this is not a ridiculous assumption, at least at first, because, of course, this response is very weak. And you'd think that if ever you could linearize, it's then. And so this is just counting the number of G proteins that you expect this rhodopsin to activate while active, right? And if it was just a single step Poisson deactivation, the ratio would be 1. So now suppose there are two deactivation steps with equal rate, then your estimate will be 1 over square root of 2, right? More generally, it's 1 over square root of n. So in order to explain this, you would have to say that there are 25 deactivation steps that are involved, right? Which would make, endow each rhodopsin with a rather accurate clock. And there are clearly few steps that are involved, but 25 is a big number. But nevertheless, it's exactly the conclusion that Rieke and Baylor reached in their paper. And they reached that conclusion by examining the alternatives. So other things that come to mind are saturation. So if the peak response was saturating at this value, right, you can imagine that we'll chop off the tail of distribution and reduce the fluctuations. The only problem, but the argument of Baylor and Rieke was, they certainly don't observe any saturation. They can very easily produce larger responses, albeit not single photon responses. Okay, so the other mechanism that comes to mind is fast feedback. So there's certainly a calcium feedback. If it is sufficiently fast, perhaps that can limit the fluctuations as well. They find that if they completely clamped calcium in their single cell preparation, they still got the same result, or at least not very much different. So what comes to mind is the following bit of physics. So several people asked already how good this stirred reactor uniform treatment of the process is, and the answer is clearly it's not always a safe approximation to make, and it's certainly not safe when you have just a single active enzyme present. So let's look a little bit more closely at what's happening on the disk in the vicinity of active rhodopsin. So it's going to, it doesn't diffuse very much. But the G proteins diffuse, bump into it, get activated, and continue diffusing in the active form until they meet up with the phosphodiesterase. So what's going to happen is, at the early times, you will have an activation spot with radius squared, with area increasing linearly with time. But the total number of active G proteins is also increasing linearly with time. So that it's activated they activate by rhodopsin at some fixed rate, so they increase linearly in time. So you expect to find some essentially constant density of active G protein in the spot of increasing size. And this spot will also contain all the essentially all the active phosphodiesterase. And outside, this phosphodiesterase will be inactive, right? So initially, right, the total activity of phosphodiesterase will also be increasing linearly in time, just as you expect naively. But then, of course, what's going to happen is the spot will stop spreading. That will happen when deactivation rate here, so let's say there's some characteristic time of hydrolysis, deactivation of this G protein times the total amount of times the total concentration of phosphodiesterase, right, integrated over the spot, so pi R squared, right, so this is the total rate of deactivation of G protein, right? So when it becomes equal to the rate with which we're producing it, the spot will stop spreading. So that defines the maximal size of the spot, and the peak, or if you like, the saturated value of activation. So,
and again, so it's spreading your production that's linear in time.
Right. So you have production that's constant, you know, the rate is constant. So, you know, if you are, So, you know, it gets deactivated. So first it has to form the complex, right? So as the spot spreads out, right, everything behind will be left as in the form of the complex, right? And that is deactivating with the constant rate. And then it becomes, it is ready to do it again, right? So it is ready to sort of reattenuate the, you know, de-excite, you know, de-excite the, you know, extinguish the next active G protein. So anyway, I'm just waving my hands through, you know, a solution, a sort of simple solution of reaction diffusion equation that you know, you can write down. Well, but I think I'm not going to write it down at this stage, and solve. So now. Yes. So now what's going to happen is if the rhodopsin lifetime is very much shorter than the characteristic time it takes to form the saturated spot, you will see essentially a linear response. At however, at the very long times, you will see saturation. You don't have to go very far into this regime to see sublinearity, and that is going to reduce the fluctuations, right? That's going to chop off the tail of the Poisson distribution. And by itself, it may not be a terribly strong effect. That is, you will not get the full factor of 5 suppression. But if you consider the effect of this weak saturation together with the you know, 1 or 2 or 3 deactivation steps, you can rather plausibly rationalize this observed, you know, 1/5 suppression. So this was meant to be an example of two things. So first of all, you certainly do have to worry about locality of signaling, and even though if when integrated over the whole cell, this single photon event may appear as weak compared to you know, the dark current, locally it is a large perturbation. So you can generate this local nonlinearity long before you generate it globally. So these local saturation effects can kick in long before the global saturation. And another headline here is for advertising purposes mostly. It wouldn't be it is often fairly easy, well, not fairly easy, not necessarily easy, but it is possible to it is much easier to dissect a simple pathway. Now, if there was just one effect that was, rather one cause responsible for this high reproducibility effect, it would be more easily amenable to the usual experimental approach where, for example, you clamp the calcium and you say, did this eliminate the observed effect or... If your effect is explained by multiple causes, each contributing a little bit, you really need some quantitative model as opposed to just qualitative reasoning. So anyway, I think I'm going to summarize right here. At this stage, we feel that we understand reasonably well how to think about these enzymatic amplifiers and what control parameters they give us to play with. Maybe we have a correct picture of G protein localization, and I guess I should say that this localization of signaling is probably even more important in the context of interactions between different pathways and limiting crosstalk between different receptors, because these rod cells are highly specialized. They only have rhodopsin and one signaling pathway in their outer segment. But these muscle cells, that myocytes that I was talking about before, certainly have multiple receptors, and they respond to multiple signals, and they may I understand that there could be half a dozen of different related G proteins doing their business in the same membrane. So having them localized, having their signaling localized, would help keep things apart.
What kind of lifespan is cycle day and
beta? Well, it depends on level of phosphodiesterase, right, which sets the time constant for degradation. So 1 second in rod cell, for example.
So it wouldn't be complex.
Precisely. You have to deactivate them before they get too far. And this localization is also acting on the level, showing up on the level of second messengers as well. So here's this rod cell again. So if you stimulate with nicely focused laser beam, right, you can make sure that right, your rhodopsin excitation is localized within the micron, and then you can record. These experiments have been done. Record the current as a function of distance from this excitation spot, and you find that the current is localized to within a few microns of the cell that's 50 microns long. And you can understand this simply by saying that the cyclic GMP is not produced, but destroyed locally, right? But there is a length scale here, which is set by its diffusivity and the time constant. And, it's not quite so simple because in order to correctly estimate the time scale here, you have to remember but cyclic GMP is actually coupled to calcium, and you sort of have two modes that are coupled, and this time scale comes out to be a little faster than you would naively estimate. But basically because the recovery of cyclic GMP is facilitated by this negative calcium feedback. But anyway, that the general idea is just this. But this is certainly measurable. So the large range of linearity of rod cell then comes basically because it is long, and it can add these different activation events independently. So it's in some sense, it's sort of quasi-digital. You can think of each event as a large and non-linear local event, which are then added linearly. So anyway, what I think is most interesting problem in this whole context is understanding adaptive regulation, understanding how these internal tuning parameters, i.e. numbers of various enzymes, can be properly and adaptively adjusted. And I think I'll stop right here. So everybody's suitably exhausted after 3 hours. No, excuse me, after 4 hours. Well, yes, of course. So either it has to be localized, or actually not all of them will use the same second messenger. Some of them will use a different second messenger, and then they can crosstalk sort of on the level of cross activation of their effector enzymes. But you know, by the time they're using the same second messenger, I think it's safely assumed that the cell is trying to integrate the two stimuli. So, in fact, if I can find it again. In this picture, there was two receptors, the beta adrenergic and the alpha adrenergic, and they actually, so they both signal to the same cyclic AMP, but with the opposite sign. I don't understand exactly what's happening here. So conceivably, this is shaping the concentration response. So perhaps they have different affinity for their ligand, and all it's doing is kicking the process in at low level and then trying to shut it off at a higher level of the stimulus. But I don't know the details here. But then typically there'll be other G protein coupled receptors here, which will plausibly be signaling through somewhat different downstream cascades.
All right, well, you guys have the afternoon off then. Oh, we have one more question.
Do you have thought that you have all this morning in this map? It was very confusing with all these connections.
Yes.
How do the biochemists explain that? Do they have certain principles, or do they see certain substructures in that? So, or do they just learn everything by heart?
Well, probably both. Okay, so now we're talking specifically about metabolism, and there's certainly a great deal of knowledge about the different sub pathways of that, and in fact how they are regulated. Even there is very little understanding on system level. The work that closest comes to that is work of Paulson and collaborators, I guess now at UCSD. And they are approaching it the official term is metabolic flux analysis. So explain this. Now there are some relations on fluxes of various components that are imposed simply by stoichiometry, right, by conservation of species. So these conservation of species really specify a bunch of linear constraints on fluxes. So, you know, basically this is saying that, let's see, how does it go? So if you define the flux as the rate with which each chemical species comes, you know, appears and disappears, right? The total rate, right? Since atoms are indestructible, right? There'll be, right? If it disappears as one species, it has to contribute to the flux of another, right? So I'm using words instead of writing equations. No, look, I'm not going to write equations. Think of it this way. This metabolism has to take in some nutrients, and it has to build biomass. The biomass is built out of amino acids in some fixed concentrations, and in some fixed ratios, I mean statistically fixed. So ultimately, you can calculate the relative amount of carbon and nitrogen and phosphorus and sulfur that you need to build that biomass. On the other hand, the nutrient sources will have their own stoichiometric ratios of all these building blocks. And the task of a metabolic system is to match the stoichiometric ratio of input molecules with input nutrients with the biomass, right? So then, of course, the cell can excrete some other compounds, and it can adjust the stoichiometric ratio. But anyway, what you get out of these stoichiometric conservation is a bunch of linear relations. And then you can ask, what is the maximal flux consistent with these linear constraints? And that becomes a linear programming problem. And you'll find a solution. Right? These linear constraints will define some a simplex, thank you, in stoichiometric space, and you expect that this maximal flux will live at the edge of the simplex, and the claim is that. That one can make some predictions out of this that compare favorably with these growth rates measured on bacteria and different nutrient conditions.
So even without the weight constants, you can make some statement about the maximum flux.
Right.
In the
system. Right. Or at least you will predict that
the argument is that the bacteria are close to that maximum flux.
Yes.
So the weight constants have evolved.
Yes. Well, again, you have to realize that they don't really have to be rate constants, because again, you can tune utilization various things just by adjusting number of enzymes. So again, it's the statement, and no mechanism is stated for how this tuning is achieved, but the claim is that bacteria live on edges of the stoichiometric space. So I think that that's sort of the closest that we come to some sort of system level analysis of these metabolic systems.